Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
This week's podcast edition of All in the Mind is different from the broadcast version because of BBC copyright reasons. But a link to the streaming audio of the BBC series that Australian audiences heard on air can be found on All in the Mind's website at abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. Meanwhile, I thought we'd bring you some historical yarns from our archives, this week unearthing some strange little beasts of the historical psyche, animal spirits. All in the Mind on ABC Radio National, Natasha Mitchell with a warm welcome. Today, a rather spirited edition of the program. We're travelling back in time to consider the mind in history, underpinning our fairly nebulous experience of a self are, of course, the machinations of our nervous system. But before the nervous system was understood to be electrical in nature, it was thought that strange little beasts called animal spirits infested our bodies and brains and were essential to who we are. So I've invited Professor John Sutton, a philosopher at Macquarie University in Sydney, to lead us through one of the most bizarre theories in the history of science and to consider what was lost when animal spirits disappeared for good.
You have all, I dare say, heard of the animal spirits, as how they are transfused from father to son, etc., etc. Well, you may take my word that 9 parts in 10 of a man's sense or his nonsense, his successes and miscarriages in this world, depend upon their motions and activity, and the different tracks and trains you put them into, so that when they are once set a-going, whether right or wrong, away they go, cluttering like hay-go-mad. Lawrence Stern, The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy, Gentleman, 1759.
We often describe our kids as high-spirited, and in moments of melancholy I might say, I'm in low spirits just now. But once, these were not mere metaphors, they were literal descriptions of the ebb and flow of what were called animal spirits, roaming our passionate nervous systems. Nowadays, you might expect to hear of animal spirits in shamanic ritual, conjuring the spirit of the bear. Economists also talk of animal spirits, after John Maynard Keynes used the phrase to describe consumer optimism, the irrational engine of capitalism. But today, we're considering the original and much stranger animal spirits. Until 200 years ago or so, in Western psychology and medical theory, animal spirits were thought to be fluids circulating rapidly around the nervous system, between sense organs, brain, and muscles. So how did the theory originate?
The idea comes from a Roman called Galen, and he basically had the idea that sitting out there in the world is this kind of rare substance. You could think of it as being a kind of like a spiritual gold almost. And it sits out there, and you can, by eating or breathing, you can take it in from the outside world, and it would be refined in the body. So it would be extracted in the liver, it would be refined again in the heart, and then you could make this special spirit, the finest, most refined spirit of all, which came by the name of animal spirit. And this was made, or believed to be made, in a system of blood vessels in the head. And this animal spirit could be used, basically it was used in the process of thinking. The way we think and the way our nerves work, according to this theory, comes about because the spirit is in our nerves and it's also in our brains. And that's how a kind of base product that you need for thinking. Indeed, in some of the earlier theories, it's not only involved in thinking, it's also involved in sight. And one of the early theories of sight is that when you see, what actually happens is that the animal spirit actually comes out of your eyes. And it, in a sense, energizes or charges the ear. And in that case, the ear becomes almost like a kind of a nerve. And that is how you see things in the outside world.
That's a wonderful, bizarre theory, isn't it?
Yes. There were difficulties with it. It was always a bit difficult to say how you could see the stars, for example. You need an awful lot of spirit for it.
Simon Kemp, a psychologist at the University of Canterbury in Christchurch, New Zealand. As well as his work on modern theories of memory and in economic psychology, Simon Kemp has written two books on medieval theories of the mind. So these fleeting animal spirits or nervous fluids buzzed around our bodies. The patterns of their flow through the fibres of our brains carried the contents of our thoughts and were believed to transmit and sometimes distort the messages of vision, memory, imagination, passion, and desire. But the old terminology used to describe these weird inhabitants of our porous brains may be a little confusing. These animated animal spirits certainly weren't animals. And when we hear the word spirit, we usually think of some ethereal substance. So is that what the animal spirits were? Simon Kemp.
Actually, it was quite complicated. They had exactly the same kind of linguistic problems that we do, because we have them too. We use spirit, obviously, you know, to describe the soul. But if you go into a bar and you order what's on the top shelf, you're buying spirits as well. So, I mean, we don't just use it as a kind of a soul-like thing. And they had much the same idea. In some of the medieval writings, actually, they're using spirit almost as a synonym for soul. It just means, you know, the sort of really spiritual, what we call spiritual type stuff. But animal spirits, when they're thinking here, they're thinking really of something which I guess is more like what you buy off the top shelf, except in this case it's the top shelf of your brain. And it's physical in that case, you see.
But why does a modern psychologist, such as Simon Kemp, find these outdated ideas about the nerves and brain so fascinating?
At first sight, the Middle Ages seem so absolutely outlandish to us. I mean, you know, there's a whole lot of people who go around on horses dressed in armour. And then even more bizarre on the cultural side, there's this enormous influence of religion everywhere and through everything. And this is so utterly alien to us. It's just quite unlike the kind of world that we live in. And it's easy to think, well, because of this, that they really are quite bizarre, that you know, everything's very different. And when you look at theories like this, you discover that actually they're not. And they actually have more in common with us, I suppose, than you'd think at first sight.
Spirit is a subtle and thin body, always movable, engendered of blood and vapour, and a vehicle or carriage of the faculties of the soul. Hilkiah Crook, 1615.
The heyday of the theory of animal spirits was the 17th century, when they cropped up in the great philosophical and medical works of the scientific revolution. One of the earliest uses of the first microscopes in the 17th century was to search for the hollow cavities or canals in the nerves through which spirits were meant to flow. The great English anatomist Thomas Willis thought that animal spirits ferment and chemically explode in the nervous system. Willis described the brain as garnished with uncertain meanders and crankling turnings and windings, in the spaces of which the animal spirits flow without us knowing. Barbara Stafford is Professor of Art History at the University of Chicago and the author of a number of books on the history of medicine and art. She argues that 18th century Enlightenment thinkers saw animal spirits as a way to solve the perennial mind-body problem.
It was the 18th century, really, that discovered the nervous system. Dr. George Cheney, Dr. Mead, and David Hartley were people who were intrigued by the animal spirits, the fact that there were fluids that coursed through the body and that seemed to unify us. I would say it was one of the great searches of the 18th century, the search to find something in between to heal the schism that Descartes had introduced between the body and the mind and matter and spirit. And it was the 18th century, really, that uncovered this windy and moist world that seemed to tie those antipathies together. You had this sort of disembodied autocratic reason, and yet people understood that there was so much else going on. There was pleasure, there was pain, there was sensibility, there was sensation. Where did that exist, and how might that be tied together? And there was this incredible invention of, I want to call them almost pseudo-materials, sort of matter that had been thinned either into a liquid or into a gaseous state that would manage to take on some of the properties, the veil-like properties of the soul, and at the same time that had a very fine-grained particulate or wave or even vibratory nature, in the case of David Hartley, And it was hoped that in that way, one could begin to construct an interior landscape that was more attuned to what people really felt was going on in their inner climate, so that all of these, as I said, liquids and gases were invented in a way to breach that great vacuum that Descartes had left.
Historian Barbara Stafford, and you're tuned to All in the Mind on ABC Radio National and internationally on Radio Australia and the web. John Sutton here with you today, exploring the mind in history and the weird idea of animal spirits. A crowd of little animals, but with teeth and claws extremely sharp. That's how the satirist Jonathan Swift caricatured the brain's animal spirits. And how he cleverly implies that the processing of our feelings, thoughts, and memories is not always comfortable. Bernard Mandeville, an 18th century physician and literary personality, described how animal spirits run through the brain when we are remembering.
When we strive to recollect something, how nimbly those volatile messengers of ours will beat through all the paths and hunt out every enclosure of the organ set aside for thinking in quest of the images we want. And when we have forgot a word or sentence, we may almost feel how some of the spirits flying through all the mazes and meanders rummage the whole substance of the brain, whilst others ferret themselves into the inmost recesses of it with so much eagerness and labour that the difficulty they meet with sometimes makes us uneasy, till at last they light by chance on the image that contains what they'd looked for, or else drag it, as it were, by piecemeal from the dark caverns of oblivion.
So how were animal spirits thought to be involved in memory? Psychologist Simon Kemp.
The basic idea is that when you perceive the world, then you take information in through your senses. And of course, this is exactly what we believe today. And then the information from your senses, say the information from what you see, comes in through your eyes and it travels up the optic nerve to your brain, which of course is exactly what we believe too. And it travels by means of the animal spirit, which is in the nerves. And then it gets to a ventricle in the brain, where it's combined with information from other senses. And then in these ventricles, the idea is that the impressions that you get from the outside world are left in the ventricles, and they're sort of almost stamped in. And in some models, they're thought of quite literally as being stamped into these little sort of tacky bits, if you like, in your brain. And then when you want to recollect them, what you do is basically is you start the animal spirits going up again, and these, I guess, register the forms, these stamped-in impressions that have been left in your brain. It's a very dynamic system, and it's not just that the fluids are there. The fluids are supposed to be moving up and down the nerves. They're supposed to be moving to and fro amongst the ventricles, and as they move, they carry information with them. Information, obviously, when you perceive information that's coming in from the outside world, you know, if you're just sort of thinking about things you've remembered or something like that, the information is just flowing.
Barbara Stafford supports this dynamic vision of the mind.
The mind and mental phenomena are about motion. No matter which way you cut it, they're about motion. And the dreaming state, the state of memory, the state of perceiving, the state of attention, the state of self-awareness, these are all states when you feel that something is happening mentally. And when you feel that your body, your physiology, your sensing apparatus is interwoven with your thinking process. And that to me also strikes me as very contemporary, very modern. At least it's not modern in the sense of those people who believe that thought is a form of computation, but more an entire other group of researchers that feel thought is something that is more fluid, is more distributed, is extended, and is pervasive, something that is located in the nervous system, at the tips of our fingers, if you will, in our eyes, in our hearing.
And the motions of our animal spirits didn't stop at night. They were considered the engine of our dreams as well. Simon Kemp.
In the normal process of perception, what happens is that information comes in through the nerves and makes its way through the ventricles. And this is controlled by a kind of, like in their theory, by the upper bits of the soul, the immortal soul. And when you're asleep, this doesn't happen. Firstly, there's not much coming in through the senses, obviously. And secondly, they believed that the whole central control by the immortal soul was suspended. So what you've got in that case is that the inner senses start to work by themselves. And in the process, the various concepts that you have stored, the various images, for example, start to move around and combine all by themselves. And this produces bizarre imagery and the kinds of phenomena that we think of as being associated with dreaming.
Animal spirits never stop for a single moment in any place, as Descartes wrote, and for this reason they were not always easy to keep in check. For moralists concerned with the control of our own thoughts and feelings, it was this mobile quality of the animal spirits which caused problems. These nervous fluids often got the blame for human error and weakness. Animal spirits could be low, broken, oppressed, dejected, petulant, harassed, or even ruffled beyond description. And in these states, animal spirits were thought to cause mental disorders like depression, neuroses, hallucinations, manias, and religious delusions.
It sometimes happens that persons whose animal spirits are highly agitated by fasting, vigils, a high fever, or some violent passion, have the internal fibres of their brains set in motion as forcefully as by external objects. Because of this, such people sense what they should only imagine, and they think they see objects before their eyes which are only in their imaginations. Nicholas Malebranche, The Search After Truth, 1674.
The state of the animal spirits depended on the quality of the blood from which they were concocted. And so any impurity or imbalance in the bodily fluids could taint the animal spirits and undermine the authority of the rational mind.
One of the common medieval beliefs about insanity was that it could be brought about by a substance called black bile, which was supposed to get into all of your body, really, but also it could get into these animal spirits. And of course, it's black, and it would sort of literally darken your spirits, and it would have exactly the sort of effects you'd expect from darkening your spirits. You know, you become depressed and anxious and fearful and so forth.
Simon Kemp, Associate Professor of Psychology at New Zealand's University of Canterbury. Memory, dreams, insanity, what else could these temperamental spirits crawl their way into? Well, sex. Animal spirits were always in on the action there too. The expense of spirit in lust was a physiological as well as a moral concern. Precious male liquors were in short supply after all. Here's one of Descartes' followers, Louis de la Forge.
The spirits of the brain are directly connected to the testicles. This is why men who weary their imagination in books are less suitable for procreative functions, while those who dissipate their spirits in debauching women cannot apply themselves to serious study.
Oh, gosh. Well, even the notion of a spirit as something volatile, something uncontrollable, something, dare I say, excitable, that mixes up, that has perhaps even a certain promiscuity to it, because the 18th century was a century of conversation, of volubility, of realizing that one idea generates another. I mean, once you get going, one thing leads to another. And that's enormously productive. I think that goes back to my point, this major, major issue, to recognize that the mind is fundamentally about motion. It's not about stasis. And, of course, motion doesn't necessarily have a fixed end to it. And that, perhaps, is exciting and dangerous.
Barbara Stafford argues that the theory of animal spirits led 18th century thinkers to doubt that their lives were entirely under conscious or rational control.
What it demonstrated, of course, was that reason was not this autocratic, all-ruling power, but that reason was constantly being inflected by other forces, other emotions, the nice and tidy faculty psychology, you know, that had reason at the top and the appetites at the bottom, which we inherited from Aristotle and that had been sort of reworked by the British empiricists, that nice, tidy hierarchy was constantly in a state of dissolution. Our internal climate was turbulent. was messy and was constantly being buffeted by many different forces that undercut any neat and tidy categorization.
So what happened to the animal spirits in the end? This is in fact a puzzling historical question. Dramatic experiments in the late 18th century revealed the role of electricity in transmitting messages through the nervous system. Did this kill off the theory of the animal spirits? Not quite. Far from rejecting these fluid spirits, some of the physiologists of animal electricity claimed that they had finally discovered their true nature in our nerves. Perhaps it was that animal spirits were too anarchic to maintain the moral decency and sensibility required of the late 18th century men and women of feeling. Barbara Stafford.
Something certainly did happen. These mixtures and so on seemed too uncontrollable, too quote-unquote unscientific. In the 18th century, science really existed within the larger frame of polite society. It was rational recreation. That's what they were called. It was meant for the cultivated, educated person. It was a way of coming to grips and understanding your own being. The 19th century, you're really on the cusp of a very new kind of specialization. And one branch of those earlier electrical experiments went in the direction, I think, of laboratory science, straight laboratory science. Another direction split off into the area of the paranormal, so that you lost really that lovely search for coherence that we are now so struggling with again today. What is all of this about but a search of how do you make the body, the mind, the brain, how do you make all these things cohere again? I think that question was last asked in a serious way in the 18th century, because the roots that were taken in the 19th were really rather different.
When you're working on a book relating our contemporary ways of thinking about the brain, the body and the mind to early modern and Enlightenment systems, but why do you think we should still be interested in these outdated theories of the nervous system and the brain?
Well, in terms of contemporary research in the fields of cognitive science, neurobiology, the new philosophy of mind, we've had really incredibly new insights into the incredibly complex ways the nervous system works, the way perception, the way the sensorium works. And I think one of the most important insights developed recently is the emphasis on the relationship between the body and the entire world that's out there. And I think those are the sorts of questions that the people you and I have been talking about have been very much interested in. They were interested in the deep mechanics of the observing body, of a body that wasn't just a vacuum, wasn't just emptied out, gutted, but a body in which there is this mind, this brain embedded. That is, again, a way I think that we can couple the past to, well, not only can, must couple the past to the present.
Barbara Stafford, Professor of Art History at the University of Chicago. The conditions of having depressed spirits or quick and nimble spirits passed from medicine to metaphor. Historical views about mind, brain, and body make it easier for us to see how science is so entangled with culture and physiology with morality. This old theory may seem superficially silly, but the imaginary animal spirits can perhaps be thought of as archaic neurotransmitters or psychosomatic worms wriggling between mind and body. It was a bewitching episode in the history of the brain sciences.
Professor John Sutton, with that excursion into the weird and wonderful world of animal spirits and the history of the psyche. If you'd like a transcript of this and any of our programs and audio of the last four, let those web spirits guide you to the All in the Mind homepage, abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. My blog and the program's email address are there too. Let it rip. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Stay spirited.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.